welcome to our show, Examine Life, on KKRN at 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain.
I'm Steve.
And I'm Pat.
And tonight's show is on rational political discourse.
So we have to read this disclaimer. Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guest, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises, or the underwriters of this station.
What we're seeing in media today, and especially on our campuses and in Washington and actually throughout the states, is really not about differences in race or gender, the rich versus the poor, immigration. The real issue is capitalism versus socialism, taking over what we think, manipulation of our thought, and that can lead to a lack of freedom of speech. I don't understand what's happening on the campuses when it comes to freedom of speech, but perhaps someone can email us at examinelife@peoplepc.com and explain that to me.
You've heard it said that a lack of knowledge of the past causes history to repeat itself. It's been 100 years since World War I, and for years prior to that first spark of violence, there was an effort to stamp out the voice of rational thinking. It turned out to be a 30-year tug of war for the radical ideologies to take power of Hitler and Stalin.
What do we want to talk about tonight? We're begging the question, have all facets of our lives now somehow can be described by politics? We want to discuss the history of discourse and how the fanatic voice becomes the meme. What's referred to as groupthink today, which is, I think, one of the most dangerous things that humanity can do. You may not like what you hear tonight, but the purpose of today's show is to start you thinking on your own, not what others want you to think. We all think we're too busy to do our homework. None of us want to go to the place, the informational place, where we actually might disagree with them, but I think we all need to start doing that.
Capitalism has spurred the growth in the middle class via opportunity for everyone, rich or poor, to build wealth. Anyone can own property. They can buy anything they want. They can do anything they want with their time and their money. They have the opportunity to accomplish anything and become rich. Otherwise, you can change your position in life for the better under capitalism.
Were there cattle barons? Were there corporate people who were unethical? And mostly the reason the way they had success with their unethical actions is because they got government cronies to help them and create laws that gave them the power to do that. Right there is where socialism would have a problem. Politicians are like everyone else. They want what they want. They are no better than the corporate guy who wants to steal. The difference is they have the police behind them.
Capitalism, however, provides us with the reward of individual efforts. It's the one social structure that works for everybody. The middle class is under attack right now, ironically, by all sides, to take control of us, to obliterate us, or to manipulate us. Tonight, we're going to put forth some ideas, rules, and the plan for changing America, much like how Europe was changed over 35 years between World War I and World War II. And we're going to start with how to create a social state. It was a book written by Richard Cloward and Francis Piven, and it was referred to as the Cloward-Piven Strategy, written in 1966, and it followed and was inspired by Saul Alinsky, who published Rules for Radicals in 1971. A year later, he died. So you can see the correlation to what's going on today.
Now, one of their primary goals was the idea of a universal basic income for everyone, and they used that to inflame the poor, to say that the rich have everything and you don't. And think about this. If you gave everyone a basic income, the people who like to make money are going to use that income to make more money, and they're still going to have a lot more than the person who doesn't like to make money or doesn't know how to make money. So even if you have this basic income, you're going to have the same argument 10 years later. The people who had the money are going to have it again, and the people who don't are going to lose it. It's just human nature.
Out of the anti-establishment protesters of the 1960s and 70s, Saul Alinsky emerged as a Chicago community activist. He was born there, and he was a graduate of philosophy at the University of Chicago. Born in 1909, and he's been called the founder of community organizing, primarily for the poor, often working with the Catholic Church and getting positive results. President Obama would follow in his footsteps 50 years later in Chicago. But around the late 1930s, Alinsky believed an organizer was for the creation of power for others to use. That was his quote. I quoted him. He touted, compromise is not a dirty word. If you have nothing and gain anything, it's a success. His first book was in 1946, was Revile for Radicals. And then his second book was called...
Well, the first book was Reveille for Radicals, which the military reveille.
Right. And his second book was Rules for Radicals. It was originally called Rules for Revolution, but nonetheless.
And that idea about any gain is success, you know, when I was trying to build my life, we had very small income, trying to raise three kids. But I had a family member who was poorer than we were, and her kids called my kids the rich kids. But my kids saw the better neighborhood down the street from us in Cottonwood, and they called those kids the rich kids. And so there's always going to be a rich and a poor, and a lot of the poor are going to resent the rich, but it's just not right. Only if they get their gains in an illegal or unethical fashion.
Saul Alinsky believed that urban slums were the result of the powerlessness of the poor, and that gangsters... who ironically had accepted him socially and referred to him as the professor, was the product of capitalistic flaws. He achieved most of his acclaim for organizing the stockyards of Chicago, parts of New York, and the Mexican immigrants, migrant workers in California. And he got positive community results. He continued to fight for the poor until the late 1960s, when the anti-establishment became popular. Then... they, in the quotations, they were the problem. The establishment was the problem.
And what I find fascinating now is that they are the establishment now.
Yeah, the irony of counter-revolution.
Yeah, instead of really trying to fix things from an individual, from groups and private groups and so on, they became the government and were lured in by all the same kind of government temptations that the previous, you know, society had.
Ironically, in his book, he warns of the counter-revolution where, I quote, the torch of idealism is carried by a group until that group becomes the establishment. And that's the concept, we become them, and it's the finest example of hypocrisy. But again, the establishment was the they, and us were the radicals.
Yep. Prior to this period, he defended the open, creative mind of man, the concepts of our founding fathers. He was ideologically compared to Thomas Paine and believed dogma was the end to freedom. Dogma, of course, now is what you hear on a lot of our campuses. It's defined as something held as established opinion, sound like a climate, or point of view put forth as authoritative without adequate grounds. But Thomas Paine was fighting an open war, and that was our rebellion against Britain.
Yeah. The two sociologists from Columbia University after the Watts riots in California in 1965, which I lived in California in Los Angeles area at that time.
And I was actually working the Watts Summer Festival that day as a 13-year-old driving a truck.
And these two, Cloward and Piven, would take the community activist strategies of Saul Alinsky and seeing the powerlessness of the slums to publish these strategies for revolution and drastic change in society. And this was intended for the betterment of the poor as they saw fit, that would be called the Cloward-Piven strategy.
Their steps to achieve socialism, to literally change our society, hope and change, was one to control health care and you control the people, and that makes sense. That's happening today.
Number two is poverty. Increase it as high as possible. Poor people are easier to control and will not fight back if you are providing everything for them to live. In the 1970s, there were 8 million in poverty. Today, there's 40 million in poverty.
And by the way, the health care has really been under control for much longer than just the ACA.
Yeah.
Gun control or debt.
Number three.
Increase debt to unsustainable levels so you're able to increase taxes and produce more poverty.
Four. The fourth step is for gun control. Remove the ability to defend themselves from the government and makes it easier to create a police state.
People are a lot more agreeable when only one side had the guns, like in Venezuela right now.
And that's ironic because in Venezuela, they took the guns from the public. And they just recently gave back 4,000 guns to the military-type supporters
actually,
of the police state.
They're not even, they're militias, but they're private. What they really did was take guns away from the private citizens and give them back to the right private citizens.
That's right, those that supported the government, the police state.
Welfare.
Number five.
Take control of all aspects of life, food, housing, and income. This program has affected family members of mine, and it's destructive and disabling.
Number six is education. Take control of what people read and listen to, as like news and media. Take control of what children learn in school, which is the indoctrination of the youth, the future people of the government.
Yeah, you know, like the Hitler Youth.
Hitler Youth. An example might be Common Core today, as we have rewritten history books.
Number seven is religion. Remove the belief in God from government and schools, because we do, for these plans like these to work, you have to believe the government is your ultimate source of rights and liberties.
And it is who you have faith and hope in. Number eight is class warfare. Divide people into wealthy and poor, the haves and have-nots. This will cause more discomfort and will be easier to take from the wealthy. Via the tax, you will get the support of the poor. But it's not for the poor, it's for the government these taxes will go. That's the irony of how government uses taxes. So these are the eight steps to achieve socialism. I find it ironic how many of these are in place now.
And I think if an idea was given to me that if we want to get more free speech in the universities, we might consider removing tenure so that you actually have to earn your way.
That's a whole nother show.
Yeah.
they also touted this giving everyone a guaranteed income. And the purpose of this was this will overwhelm the government bureaucracies, along with these other steps, to force economic collapse accompanied by social unrest, and a society will be intimidated by threats of violence to make big changes in favor of a controlled society or socialism.
And it essentially serves no purpose, because you can raise incomes all you want, but again, the people who want to have more money than other people will have it. And who's to say that they shouldn't be allowed to do that? So in 10 years, no matter what you do with incomes, there will be the poor people who are going to complain to the rich people or complain about them, even if they got all their money from ethical and hardworking means.
In this strategy, they also, in their book, they urge community activists to recruit poor families to demand government subsidies and promote the poor against the rich mentality, the haves versus the have-nots. And this is not the answer.
And that's what we see today. I've had discussions with people, because I like to have discussions with people that don't agree with me, and more of you should do that. And I had one with someone the other day that someone else, the big thing is profit. Well, those companies are making 15%, 20%, 30% profit. Well, if you're on welfare or if you're on disability of any kind, aren't you at 100% profit? Why is your profit not evil and their profit is evil?
Well, I don't think it's evil. It's just looked down upon.
Well, they people talk about it like it is, like it's all had to be ill-gotten gains.
When this book was published, this strategy was published, Alinsky published a second book called Rules for Radicals, and he takes on their concepts and changes. And he buys into the change means movements, movement means friction, abrasive friction, i.e. violence, results in change.
Right.
And that's how he perceived the second, good part of his book is about organizing schools. In fact, he ran a university or a training facility for community organizers. But as we got into the 60s and 70s, he became more of an activist.
And he stated radicals must have a degree of control over the flow of events. You know, we're doing that now with these people seem to want groupthink. They want everyone to think the same way, and whatever your argument is, it has to be correct. You should listen to me and not try to think for yourself. And, you know, does anyone really have all of the answers? I just don't think that's true. I think you need to invite speech that completely disagrees with you in order to gain more perspective on your own ideas.
His book addresses, a good part of his book, addresses the ethics of morality or the morality of a means to an end. That he goes on and on and on about supporting this document or this doctrine of the ethics or morality of means to an end. And we're going to talk about that tonight.
And, of course, morality is also a relative thing. I mean, ethics and morality. Whether or not you are a religious person or a non-religious person, that affects what your morals are. So if you are non-religious and you want to say that a religious person's morals are incorrect, where's your basis for being right? And vice versa. You know, you believe in God, but the other person doesn't, so your morals are better? No, no one has the lock and key for the morals.
And this ethics or morality of a means to end is somewhat about the revolution, which equals change in thought to result in major social change. And in the book, he sets out the mechanics of mass movement and how to implement that change.
And what my thought is you know, there are countries all over the world. There are capitalists, nothing like the United States, but there are capitalistic societies. There are socialists. There are communists. There are dictatorships, all the sorts. Why do we want to change the one country that is a representative republic when there are other countries that are socialist? Why not go there and either change that socialism or live in that socialism? Why not allow all different types of government? Why do we have to have one?
Well, this is the radical theme right now. He classifies everybody into three categories: the haves, the have-nots, and those that are in the middle class as what he calls having a little and wanting more. And he refers to the middle class as the non-doers, yet these are the achievers in business. The middle class is who starts business. They provide jobs. They support local communities. And the middle class has produced many world leaders.
I was lower class. I became middle class through my work. I maintained being middle class through owning a business. The middle class is where everything happens. I don't know why you would want to say that the middle class are non-doers.
Well, he labels them that as accepting the status quo without wanting change for fear you're going to lose something.
And they don't. That's how the middle class become the upper class. They don't accept I didn't accept the status quo in the largest corporation of our type in the country. And by doing so, my bosses hated me, but I always made them a big profit by doing good customer service against their will.
Well, he aligns middle-class people with the haves. His book says, all societies discourage and penalize ideas and writings that threaten the ruling status quo. And he feels that their fear of action or fear of rebellion causes them to take refuge in ethics. They are not activists, but want to continue with the status quo for their own peaceful lives.
Again, sound like any universities that you've heard about recently?
Well, this is how he describes us in the middle class. He talks about power politics, that laws written for the lofty aim of common good and then acted out in life on the basis of common greed. That's how he describes power politics. And then they come up with the right reason for justifying their politics. This is an affront on not only the right from wrong, but on capitalism.
The premise of the rules, to quote him, is for have-nots to take power. He urged followers to be flexible and opportunistic and say anything to get power, which they can then use to radically change existing social and economic institutions. See, the problem is that when you talk about things like socialism and socialistic societies, you don't have a society changing itself. You have a small group of people who believe that they know more than everyone else, and they will direct what the rules and regulations are and how people will live their lives and who should have how much money.
This is we're going to give you kind of a Reader's Digest version of a few of these rules. We're not going to go over all of them. But one of them is power is not only what you have, but what the enemy thinks you have. Your power comes from money and people. On one side, we all have the strength to endure the misfortunes of others. And on the other side, we have one's concern with ethics varies inversely with one's distance from this scene of conflict. That means the closer you are to the conflict, your idea of what is ethical is going to change. And that's not true. Think about it. Ethics is supposed to be what's right and what's wrong, and it should not vary dependent upon your distance from what was going on.
A good example of that right now is the problem we have with the Islamist violence that's going on. Those of us who are not in the Middle East experiencing this violence, the Muslims who are living in the Middle East are being terrorized by these people, I would say probably have a different sense of ethics than the people sitting back here safe in the United States who are saying, oh, we should just smile at them and not make them mad at us.
Another one of them, the number two, we'll use as a numbering system. Judgment of ethics is dependent upon the political position of those sitting in judgment, meaning depending on what my ethics is if I'm the judge or not.
The victors write the history.
Yeah, and that's not morally right. And I'm sorry, but ethics to me is about what's right and wrong, and morality is the same about what's right and wrong.
That's right. And perceived injustices depends, number three, numerically, depends on which side you were on. And that's clearly demonstrated by the haves not wanting all of their money taken by the have-nots, and the have-nots believing that the haves have already taken all their money. Whether or not they earned it or threw it away or whatever they did, they believe that the reason the haves have it is because they should have it.
And on this perceived injustices, depending on what side you're on, never speak of the benefits. Only one side is to be spouted in defense of your view. They are evil and unjust, and we are righteous. Find ways to increase insecurity, anxiety, and uncertainty so you can create fear against them. It's us against them.
That may be the rules of revolution, but it sounds like a religion to me.
Is not some of fanaticism?
They are evil and unjust. We are righteous.
This is also a religious fanaticism that you see.
That's right.
Throughout history.
But they don't like to call it religious in this case,
right.
But that's what it is.
Moral judgment is based on politics. We would denounce the same tactics if we were on the other side. Is this not what we call hypocrisy today? I mean, is really? I find that one really disconcerting.
And interestingly, and a little bit hypocritical, is concerns for ethics increase with the amount of means or options available to you. Ask, will it work?
And if it does, it's justified. And we saw this with Harry Reid in the 2012 presidential race. He lied about Mitt Romney, and then just before the election, and then after the election, someone mentioned to him that that was a lie, and he says, oh, but it justified the means.
Yeah, the means ends justify the means.
He literally said that on camera.
Yeah, it's and number seven, success is a mighty determinant of ethics. If you succeed, all is okay. And that's because we all like to justify our actions and believe that we're good humans. That's why a lot of people's political beliefs are not based on their own logical beliefs. They're based upon what makes me seem like a good human to the people that I want to seem like a good human to.
Yeah. Number eight for, just in discussion, never let up. Keep trying new things to keep them off balance. This is constant criticism. This is ridicule. This is what this is.
And the next one, do what you can with what you have and clothe it with moral garments.
Which is a form of justification.
And see, we hear throughout these rules, we see ethics and morals constantly being talked about and being manipulated as nothing more than tools.
Another one is, if your enemy is ruthless, you are a fool to stick with passive resistance. Act. It's easier to attack a person than an idea. Ridicule is man's most potent weapon. Pick the target, personalize it, and polarize.
And we should not be afraid of this tactic. I go to many websites to blog with people who disagree with me. And I always find it to be comforting and a victory when instead of answering my logical question, they call me a name. I see that as a victory. That doesn't, the old sticks and stones things. They can call me all the names they want, but I just stay calm and ask the question again. I'm just looking for an answer. So, those are the rules. We'll continue with this discussion in a little bit. This is Examine Life. And we are going to take a break for just a couple of minutes. We're about halfway through our program.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on, and my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this, a kiss to build a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me, and my imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part, a kiss to build a dream on.
Join the discussion. KKRN boasts a variety of talk radio, both from local and syndicated sources. We want to stimulate thoughtful and meaningful conversation. KKRN can offer more real conversation because we are supported by listeners. You have a voice.
Make them believe they're true. Oh, give me your lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live.
The infinite possibilities of music are showcased by the eclectic panorama of song styles that you can find on KKRN Radio. You won't find our musical explorations on more mainstream commercially driven stations. From classic country to new age, from classic folk to classic rock, from blues to jazz, and music from outside our country. You'll find it all on KKRN listener-supported radio, radio that makes you listen.
You're listening to Examine Life on KKRM 88.5 FM.
I'm Steve.
I'm Pat. And views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guest, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station.
Saul is quoted as saying, "The haves developed their own morality to justify their means employed to maintain the status quo. And where men speak of moral principles, they act on power principles." And I want to say that I agree with him. an example, one of my favorite examples of the old and the new is the movie The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman, and the establishment, the conservative establishment, and how stale and everything, you know, they wanted to maintain that status quo. The problem is that we have the same problem now in the opposite direction.
Well, it speaks of men speak of moral principles, but they act on power principles. They act on their own benefit. They're what benefits them and gives them more power rather than on what morality is. And then, you know, like it goes back to, you know, do what you want and then clothe it in morality.
Right. And he mostly just talks about tactics. It's if, you know, if you really believe in your ideals and your principles, you still should be open to discussion. And these tactics are about preventing active discussion.
Yeah.
The avoidance of debate or argument of the movement can be achieved by deflection, political correctness, anything but intellectual debate. And I've experienced this over and over, and I enjoy it. Again, the means justifies the end. The book promotes manipulation of people, what they think, the narrative, the face of the cause. And by the way, that's why fascism is called fascism, because there's a face that represents the cause.
And this they do via stonewalling, stalling, stating untruths as truths, and gaining gaining ground any way you can. It goes back to that, what Harry Reid said, where he just out and out lies, and then after the fact, he comes out and says, yes, but it just, you know, the means justified the ends. This goes back to stating untruths as truths. We, as a society, get bombarded, and one of the tactics is of Marxism is come up with the most outlandish lie and keep repeating it until everyone believes it.
And what I find, the small amount that I find refreshing in my daily political explorations, is that both sides of our polarized politics right now, they all seem to be saying the same words and the same phrases. And nobody's, and that shows that no one's thinking.
To describe the other side, yeah.
Well, for anything, to describe their ideas or the other side, they're all in this groupthink, and no one's thinking for them. Well, I shouldn't say no one. The refreshing part is when I see the people who are thinking for themselves.
Saul Alinsky states, manipulation is what an organizer does. This is what this is all about. It's manipulation of what you think, the narrative of you, and the face of the cause. This is what it's all about, is the manipulation. And he states that's the job of the organizer.
And profanity used like a bulldozer effect. And what are you hearing now in a lot of the demonstrations going on? Just these statements of violence and hatred.
What it does is, he states, it gets their attention and takes control of the conversation, thereby stealing power. Again, power, it gives the manipulation. You can manipulate much easier if you have the power. It's all about taking power from them for us.
Never let the enemy score points.
No.
And this is probably someone who was against war, but look at his language.
Yeah, you maneuver and bait the establishment or the enemy. So that you manipulate. The maneuver is the same, another word for manipulation. And don't become old news. This goes back to keep pounding on the same lie, the same rhetoric, whatever it is. Keep it fresh by another angle of the same argument. And never let the enemy score any points.
Alinsky's book warns of the counter-revolution, whereby the torch of idealism is carried by a group, until that group becomes the establishment.
We just talked about that. The concept, we become them. And it happens over and over and over in history. Everybody wants to take power, and as soon as they get it, they act just like the guy that they took it from.
Because I, for one, live by old sayings because I think they're wise, and one of them is power corrupts.
And
absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's just a fact. You can believe it or not, but it's a fact. So now who's in power? And is that person going to become?
That's That's precisely what happened in Venezuela, too, where they criticized the establishment, the government, as it being out of control, corrupt. And then soon as the new order won elections, guess what they did? They took more power. They corrupt more. They took. They became a military state. They took away all the freedoms, all the rights of the individual. So it's, you know, Castro did the same thing in Cuba. It's happened over and over and over.
It's just that each side thinks that they would not do that and the other side would.
It goes back to human nature.
So let's make a little bit of a religious analogy here. Lest we forget.
This is Alinsky's personal quote, personal acknowledgement at the end of his book.
Lest we forget, at least an over-the-shoulder acknowledgement to the very first radical. From all our legends, mythology, and history, and who is to know where the mythology leaves off and history begins, or which is which? The first radical known to man who rebelled against the establishment and did it so effectively that he at least won his own kingdom, Lucifer.
Isn't that sad? Now, this is, and I, again, this goes back to the radical thought of justifying the means to an end.
The ends justify the means.
Yes. It goes back to whatever works.
And interestingly, considering our current environment, Alinsky did not believe in joining political parties. When asked on an interview whether he ever considered becoming a Communist Party member, he replied, "Not at any time. I've never joined any organization, not even the ones I've organized myself. I prize my own independence too much. Some of that emotion we could use today." Yeah. And philosophically, I could never accept any rigid dogma or ideology. Oh, my goodness.
I know.
I'm just not going to say anything there.
No.
Whether it's Christianity or Marxism.
We're still quoting him.
One of the most important things in life is what Judge Learned Hand described as that ever-gnawing inner doubt as to whether you're right. If you don't have that, if you think you've got an inside track to the absolute truth, you become doctrinaire, humorless, and intellectually constipated. The greatest crimes in history have been perpetrated by such religious and political and racial fanatics, from the persecutions of the Inquisition on down to communist purges and Nazi genocide.
Isn't this true? Everything's done in the name of religion. And we see it again today with ISIS. They're justifying their means under the guise of religion. And they have hijacked the Islamic religion. And it's sad. The fringe is now, it's like the tail wagging the dog idea.
Right. I think, and a lot of what I'm seeing in politics of people who are not religious or don't want to be seen as religious seems very religious in its just absolute belief.
Right. And I think we lose sight of where all of this comes from. And if we don't study history, it will repeat itself.
And it looks like it's doing it right now. Revolutionary ideas unnecessarily limit an organizer, he said. Rather, an organizer should have a free and open mind and political relativity that allow him to respond to the realities of the widely different situations our society presents. Alinsky's discussion of means and ends most concretely expressed his relativism. In war, he argued, the end justifies almost any means.
And this is true in war. The thing about World War II and Pearl Harbor and how we were attacked, and the war was going on and on and on, and it got to the point of, okay, are we going to invade the island of Japan? How many lives will that cost us? 100,000, they estimated, and that's when they elected to use the hydrogen bomb.
A quick aside, I know we don't have a lot of time, but Pearl Harbor, I've read a lot of history about Pearl Harbor, and it appears that the reason they attacked us when they did, and this is me explaining why we don't want to have socialism where politicians are in charge of anything, that all of our bureaucrats and politicians and embassy personnel and so on, the Japanese had sent us their latest communique, and there was so much jockeying for which of our people would have their face showing and have their ideas put forward that the delay was so long that the Japanese thought we were going to attack them.
It goes back to politicizing everything and the power struggle, even within the military, within the government on every level. There is a power struggle.
And so, and it's not evil. It's just people are people. So we don't want someone to have the power of the badge any more than we absolutely have to.
And open mind, it goes back to, do you truly have an open mind? Do you entertain the other guy's point of view? We cannot demonize anyone as them and think we are absolutely right. History has proven, no matter how right you think you are now, in 3 decades from now, you were not right.
That's correct. And so all I ever do is ask questions and want an answer that is logically reasonable.
Right. Exactly. As a labor organizer and scholar, Jane McAlevany, put in her recent book, No Shortcuts, which is the title of her book, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age, Alinsky was not known for his governance skills. His legacy has encouraged the union movement to embrace the bureaucratic pressures all unions face rather than resist them. Those pressures have helped lead to the legalistic grievance procedures, closed-door bargaining, and staff-led corporate campaigns that characterize the labor movement today and severely depress rank-and-file engagement, enthusiasm, and mobilizations. You don't see the kind of union boycotts or walkouts that you used to see. It's all done behind closed doors now.
Right, and that's a typical example of the absolute power. They started for good reasons, but now they're just about the people in power and what they want, not about the rank and file.
They want power, and they also want the money that power gains them.
Cesar Chavez, a United Farm Workers, said that organizers rather than local leaders were the crucial people who made politics happen. The organizers were, he said in 1969, the heroes of the farm worker movement. Without the guidance of skilled organizers, rank-and-file leaders would be forever trapped in a competitive individualism, incapable of building their own movement. That idea came from Saul Alinsky.
And it was a good idea. They needed to have some sort of grievance, and their only recourse was to use organizers. And it did achieve what they needed to achieve.
Alinsky never questioned Marxism or human nature. He thought communism was dogmatic. His influence weighted heavily on the forming of the progressives for communists to regroup after the fall of communism, long before the Berlin Wall came down.
Yes, he promoted the idea of open-mindedness being a progressive, and that's embracing all ideas. But as we've seen on college campuses, that's not necessarily true. An example of extremism today on that level is at Evergreen College, where they're protesting for what no white days on campus, meaning no white people are allowed on campus.
Segregation all over again. I thought we were over this.
I know. And it's like they talk about hate speech is replacing free speech as defined by what I think only is acceptable speech. The same thing with this white days only. It's okay for us to discriminate, but not for you. It's like, I don't understand that.
And it's not a good thing in either direction.
Accepting violence.
It doesn't make any sense to me. And that's one of the problems with having your only listening to your own idea. That idea becomes warped because there's no outside input. It's kind of like an inbreeding of the mind.
Accepting violence on campuses is thumbing one's nose at the rule of law that defines all of us. It cries rebellion, force change, and the Alinsky rule that, to me, ethics is doing what is best for the most. This isn't right or wrong. It's not even moral. But it's an elitist attitude of, I know what's best for you, do as I say is okay to say. This is not freedom of speech. And I think political correctness is overshadowing freedom of speech. And now we're calling stuff hate speech. Freedom of speech is, I don't care how much you hate what they're saying. It is not hate speech. Sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. That's what we were taught as kids. It's not what you say. You've got the freedom to disagree with me. You have the freedom to call me anything, and I can call you anything. But it goes back to my rights end where yours begin, and your rights end where mine begin.
And the thing is, I've been around lots of people of all races and colors and cultures for my whole life. And around, you know, from the 90s, even the 80s, but the 90s and the 2000s, you know, young people especially were all getting along, between the races.
We did.
They just didn't recognize racial boundaries.
And we called each other names.
And now we're back to doing that again. And I just don't, I know in my mind how we got here, but it's sad because we had just about conquered it. And now we've brought it back again.
And we're getting too much into feelings. We have had decades of, if it feels good, do it. I've recently heard a high school senior comment, this is his parents' suggestion on how to live his life. Yet we all know decisions based on emotions, which are feelings, are usually not good ones. Alinsky wrote, look for ways to increase insecurity, anxiety, uncertainty. Keep your message clear. Feeling secure adds to the backbone of anyone. This talks about feelings. Dwell on their feelings. This is not the way to make decisions.
And that's why when I discuss politics on blog sites and so on, I discuss it in terms not of parties, but of human nature. You know,
feelings.
Do you believe, like the idea that, that the guy who has made a lot of money for himself, if you take away all of his money, he's going to have it again in 10 years because that's what he does. The person who has become poor, if you give them a bunch of his money, in 10 years they're going to be poor again unless they change their way of thinking.
And this feeling idea comes back to those who live in glass houses should not throw rocks. You know, I want to feel good about something, so I'm going to do X, but don't ask me to really do anything serious. I just want to feel good about giving the money.
Right.
I don't want to really go down to the soup kitchen and serve soup or volunteer somewhere to help the poor or those that have been displaced in their homes from fire or something. Let me give money to make me feel better.
Or especially let me say that tax it. And if I'm someone whose income is low enough that I don't pay taxes, it's very easy to say, well, let's just do it through taxes. When I was a kid, we were very poor and didn't have food a lot of the time. And private citizens left food on our doorstep for the holidays sometimes.
Yes.
That's how it should be done. And any other way is just lazy.
And that was insincere. And that was anonymous.
Anonymous.
You never knew who did it.
We never saw him.
Historically, preceding genocide, there is a hatred of people. And prior to that, there is a ridicule of a people, a culture, or a belief to inflame the public. It's them against us, the threat. The promotion of the idea they are the cause of all of our problems. Be it a lie or not, deflect from the core issue and create a cause of discourse. This is what's going on now. Fanatics take their time to take control. Unfortunately, we are seeing this over and over again. They, whoever they is the problem. We are all in this together. It is all our problem. That's why we get to vote.
We're kind of reverting back to our prehistoric days when we all lived in small villages and they were usually dangerous. And somehow, with all the technology and all the societal changes, we're kind of back where we started.
I know. And, this idea of manipulating your thoughts, controlling one's thinking. Remember, we are what we think, which makes us act in a manner consistent with our thoughts. It goes back to that concept, I think I'm fat, I'm going to act like a fat person. I think I'm being persecuted, I'm going to act that way. We create our own narrative internally. Now they are trying to manipulate that internal thought process.
And the name calling, I referred earlier to going to blog sites where I ask logical questions and people just call me names. that's a perfect example of this. That their names don't hurt me.
No.
Matter of fact, I take them as a badge of honor. They obviously can't respond to me, so they call me a name. They tell me I'm stupid, or they tell me that I believe that all poor people are fat and lazy, or whatever the discussion might be about, instead of just answering a question. And so those names don't hurt me. So if you run across a racist, as stupid as they are and as small-thinking, unless they do an action, they're harmless. 100 years ago, when there were a majority of racists in some areas, then it might have been harmful. That's not the case anymore.
Yeah, the KKK has been dismantled. Besides that, we will do in a crowd or amongst our group,
yeah,
things we would never do alone. And wouldn't do it because they usually defy common sense and we know them to be wrong. And yet we'll get in a group think, or we'll get into a crowd. And I think this is what's happening on college campuses. I don't have anything to do tonight. Let's go down and see what's happening in the streets. And the next thing you know, they're getting caught up in these riots, basically. And I don't think everyone there is standing behind the group think.
And the idea that some speaker can come to the college and they consider it so dangerous that they shouldn't be allowed to speak. I don't know. I think the universities will probably end up going away. Education's about to take a big technological change, and it might end up being a good thing now.
I don't know. It's sad to think that our youth are being subjected to this again. When in the 1970s, or 60s even, a lot of it was against the Vietnam War, is a lot of where it started.
And just against the status quo.
Yes. But what we're seeing today is not necessarily about either of those things. It's not about war. It's not about terrorism. It's not about the things that are on the forefront of our country right now. It's about these small-minded things.
Yeah, it's more of a joining a group. And here's an example. There are feminists out there who believe in the complete independence of women, as I do, and yet you can't get them to say anything bad about a society where women are considered second-class citizens who can be stoned for certain actions. That means that they've bought into a whole narrative, not just their feminist ideals. And that's where we're going wrong.
And one of the things you might entertain doing, agree with us or not, but in the climate of having an open mind, is read the book Animal Farm.
That's right. Animal Farm is a clear picture of human nature. Depicted as animals. Interestingly, the pigs were the one in charge. But anyone who hasn't read that book, or even if you read it a long time ago, read it again. And again, our email is examinelife@peoplepc.com. Read that book and tell me what you see about it that's incorrect. It's not a very long book. It's easy to read. No offense meant, but
there are some kids that are still required to read it in junior high school and high school.
And watch how socialism can work and how it ends up, because human beings are what they are. Freedom is always best, because you have to be responsible for freedom and you have to work for it.
And democracy works on the level of the majority rules idea. And the majority can be a small majority. But we have always stood by the fact that whoever the majority is that won, we all fall in line behind it until we have the next opportunity to change, to vote them out and vote what we want in. And that's how it should be. The majority rules and you get behind the acting majority until the time comes for you to get your voice again.
And of course, the argument's going to be that there was a raw majority vote, and then there was the actual electoral college vote, which had to do with counties and gave rural people as much influence as urban people had. But the bottom line is that's the way we elect people, and it's very possible it could have turned out the other way with a popular vote had that been the reason. These political races are just that. They're political races.
And there is no one person who has ultimate control. That's the beauty of democracy.
Yeah.
Well, it's how our system works. No one person has that kind of control. And if you don't like it, you vote them out, or their party out, or their party platform, or the ideas they're promoting. That's what you do as a democracy. And until you get that voice, you tote the line and follow the rule of law.
And you should consider at least supporting whoever's in charge, especially in dangerous time like today. Challenge them, but challenge them on the merits of things that you have researched, not what some person has told you you need to think about. Don't just, if you watch the news, don't just watch news programs that say the things you want to hear. Watch the ones that say the things you specifically don't want to hear.
Well,
discuss things with people who disagree with you.
Let us dismantle the efforts to create chaos and fear among us with rational debate, conversation, and eventually compromise. Compromise is a good thing, and it lets everyone have a fair argument. And again, majority rules even after the argument is done. But let us dismantle those efforts to create chaos and fear among us. We should not fear one another. We should not demonize any group of people that we think is our enemy. They may not be, after all.
And think for yourself.
Time changes our perspective. What was okay speech-wise when I was a kid is now politically incorrect, which I find, as we've gotten supposedly bigger-minded, things have gotten more restrictive.
And we're not talking about racism. We're just talking about harmless statements. Anyway, obviously, they've finally gotten around to shutting us up. So, once more, views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station. This has been Examine Life. Examine Life at peoplepc.com.
Please, we just invited you to think outside the box and with an open mind for the benefit of our country, to make our country go forward as a whole, not fragmented and torn apart from within.
Let's stop groupthink. Have a beautiful night. Have a beautiful summer. We'll talk to you on our next program.
Thank you and good night.
Good night.